Welcome to the Joseph Campbell Audio Collection. This talk is called New Horizons. It's the fourth selection in the series entitled Mythology and the Individual. And now, Joseph Campbell.
Ladies and gentlemen, the other day, when sitting at a lunch counter that I like to go to, a little boy about 12 years old came in and sat beside me with his school satchel. And beside him was a still younger gentleman of learning, about 6, holding his mother by the hand. And they sat on the counter beside me. And while he was waiting for his order to be filled, my little companion said, "In class today, Jimmy wrote a paper on the evolution of man." And the teacher told him he was wrong, that Adam and Eve were the first parents. The lady, 2 seats away, said, "Well, teacher was right." And the little boy said, and for this I was going to recommend him for a medal and grant in aid, he said, "Yes, I know, but this was a scientific paper." The mother, 2 seats away, came back and said, "Yes, but those are only theories." And the little boy was up to that one, too. He said, "Yes, but they have been factualized. They found the bones." Well, I thought, this is great. But what a teacher. Now let us try to remember for a moment the wonderful world image that is being destroyed, that is being dissolved, that is disappearing under the impacts of the thoughts of little boys like this. In the great works of the 12th and 13th century, the earth was the center of the universe. There were 2 views of the earth. One, the popular view, saw it as a flat surface, like a dish, surrounded by an ocean, a cosmic ocean, in which demonic beings existed that were dangerous to man. This is an infinitely old notion about the universe. But there was a more sophisticated notion than this, namely that of Ptolemy, of the earth as a sphere, surrounded by 7 crystalline spheres, in each of which there was a planet. The planets and spheres after which the 7 days of the week are named. The moon and sun, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. And each of these sang a song. This was the music of the spheres. They were angels. These were angelic living spheres surrounding the universe. And beyond this, there was the great heavenly realm where God sat on his throne. And when the soul of man came down into birth, it passed through these 7 spheres and picked up at each an element. There were 7 elements associated with the 7 spheres. And so our body is a compound of the elements of the universe, and it sings the same song, so to say. And the society of the Middle Ages was itself a rendition on earth of the imagery of those 7 spheres. The entity of the king and the entity of the pope, these represented agents of the divine powers. And the society was arranged in a hieratic way, as it were, following the order of the angels and the angelic choirs who sang in the heavens. And in this image, there was felt to be a perfect accord between the shape and form of the universe, the well-being of the individual, and the order of society, so that by following the laws of the society and doing as he was told, the individual both was in accord with the order of the universe and with his own inward order. And then when death came, he passed readily through those spheres again to the heavenly realm. And you know how Dante developed this image in the Divine Comedy in perfect harmony with the ideas of his time. When Satan had been flung out of heaven for his disobedience and pride, he came like a great flaming comet, Lucifer, and struck the earth and drove right through to the center. And that area that he struck, that great trench to the center, is hell. And what was driven forth the other side is the mountain of purgatory. And it was supposed that the whole southern hemisphere was an ocean, with the mountain of purgatory, what now would be called the South Pole. And on the summit of this mountain of purgatory was paradise, the garden, from which the four rivers flow in the four directions. Well, now it's a curious fact, but when Columbus set sail for the lands beyond the surrounding ocean, he had the image of Dante's world in mind, and he writes of this in his journal. And when he reached the mainland, or the islands of the Indies, he turned southward, and he reached the shore, I think this was on his third voyage, of South America. And as he was passing between Trinidad and the shore of South America, he noticed that the quantity of fresh water mixed with the salt was simply enormous. The River Orinoco, this enormous river, such as no European had ever seen, was pouring great quantities of fresh water into the ocean, and Columbus thought that this must have been one of the four rivers of paradise coming from the mountain of paradise in the southern hemisphere. And he noticed when his boat sailed northward that it went more swiftly than it had gone when it was sailing southward. And he says, this is because we were coasting downhill from this promontory of the great mountain. St. Thomas Aquinas, writing of paradise in the 13th century, said, the reason people have not found paradise is that it is beyond the great seas or beyond great mountains, and people haven't come to it yet. It was literally thought that the notion of the earth in the Bible was literally true. Some 50 years after Columbus's shattering, or beginning to shatter, of the mythological geography of the Middle Ages, Copernicus published his paper on the heliocentric universe, placing not the earth, but the sun in the center of the universe. And some 60 years after that, Galileo's telescope, puny little telescope, verified this situation. And you know that Galileo was condemned by the Holy Inquisition. He was condemned for holding and teaching a theory that was contrary to Scripture, just as the little boy beside me, the year 1961, was condemned by his mother for the same fault. This was a very solemn condemnation. Galileo was declared to be teaching false doctrine because his facts were contrary to Scripture. And I think what we now would say, would have to say, would be that Scripture cannot be true since it does not agree with the facts. That is to say, the position is reversed. Galileo's telescope was followed by many larger. And today we have these glorious eyes on, for instance, Mount Wilson Observatory. And not only is the sun the center of our little planetary cluster, the sun is but one of 200 billion stars in a galaxy shaped like a great lens, with hundreds of thousands of light years distances from one to the other side. And not only that, but these telescopes now are finding in the midst of these numerous stars galaxies, that is to say nebulae, which are further galaxies, more and more, thousands and thousands. So that actually the religious experience of awe before the universe, which the medieval picture was supposed to communicate, is transcended billions of times by the image that modern science is presenting to us. One might say it is a far more magnitudinous revelation than anything the pre-scientific world possibly could have conceived of. And the little story in Genesis seems a kindergarten tale in comparison. Similarly, the old history has fallen apart. Not only the cosmos of the scripture, but the history. Already Sir Walter Raleigh, who was a great mariner, observed when he reached the American shores the number of the animals here, the new species that had never been named before in the old world. And he thought, well, how could you have fit these into the ark? And it was already obvious that the story of the flood was a mere myth. That is to say, a theory that could not be factualized. Further, the sort of view of human history that Darwin's evolutionary theory opened up puts the origins of mankind hundreds of thousands of years back. We now date the first hominids at the time of the first glacial period, perhaps 600,000 or some date of 1 million BC. And again, the little story in scripture has collapsed. There was no flood. There was no universal flood. And if we reckon the first hominids as the first man, his son did not build the first cities. The first cities were not built for another 600,000 years. So again, there's a little kindergarten story there, that the magnitude of the modern scientific view has simply rendered childish. The experience of awe before the wonder of mankind is now something far greater than anything that first book of the Bible can give us. Still further problems arose with the findings of archaeology. For example, the period in Egyptian history that is supposed to have been that of the Exodus is one very well documented in Egyptian texts. It's the period of Ramses II and Merneptah. There's no record anywhere of those seven plagues. There's no record anywhere of anything even comparable. And the Pharaoh, who is supposed to have been drowned with his army in the Red Sea, we have his mummy. It's not at the bottom of the Red Sea at all. The texts in which these stories appear have been analyzed. They're found to have been extremely late. The Pentateuch, the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, were edited together of a number of manuscripts as late as the 3rd century B.C. And these documents date from about the 9th century to about the third. One notices, for instance, that there are two accounts of the flood in the Bible. The editor was not too careful, you might say. In one, Noah is told to bring into the ark two animals of every kind. In the other, he is told to bring seven pair of every clean and two of every unclean beast. Similarly, there are two stories of creation, the one in chapter 2 and the one in chapter 1. In chapter 2, man is created, then the plants, then the animals, and then Eve is drawn from his rib. In chapter 1, first, God says, let there be light, and so forth, and we have the 7 days, the animals, and so forth, and man and woman are created simultaneously. These are two stories. The story in chapter 1 dates from about the 3rd century. The story in chapter 2 dates from about the 9th. Moreover, comparative mythology and anthropology have shown that comparable stories appear all over the world. When Cortes arrived in Mexico, he and his company who had come, among other things, to carry the faith, the cross, and the one true religion, found so many parallels to their own belief among the Aztecs that they were hard put to explain it. Here were great temples representing the spheres of the universe, like the medieval Mountain of Purgatory. There were 13 heavens with choirs of angels, 9 hells filled with demons, and there was a deity, Quetzalcoatl, whose symbol was the cross, and who died and was to be resurrected. The Padres invented 2 theories to explain this phenomenon. One theory was that St. Thomas, the apostle to the Indies, had reached the American shores and had preached the gospel. But that being so far removed from the center of truth, namely Rome, the doctrine deteriorated, and what they were observing was a degenerate development of their own teaching. The other theory that was proposed by many, many of the serious thinkers was that the devil was throwing up parodies of the Christian teaching in order to frustrate the mission. There were stories of the virgin birth, of death and resurrection, and the whole treasury of motifs. Furthermore, when in the 19th century systematic studies were made of the religions and mythologies of mankind throughout the world, innumerable parallels were found. China, with the Buddhist heavens and hells. India, with the Hindu heavens and hells and purgatories. And then looking back into the deeper, darker backgrounds, ancient Egypt had its stories of like kind. The mythology of Osiris is actually a model for the mythology of the Christ. Now, in each of these cases, each of these great civilizations regarded itself as the center of the universe, regarded the barbarians or Gentiles as aliens in God's domain, regarded themselves as the bearers of the mandate, so that we have a number of symbolic centers representing the center of things. And in the modern world, these are being smashed along with that wonderful image of the medieval universe. Now, this is a very serious affair. It is serious because these symbolic worlds were the supports of the civilizations, of the moralities of the civilizations, of the self-confidence of the civilizations, of the vitality and creative power of the civilizations. And with the cutting down, the frustrating of the self-confidence that derives from images of this kind, there is a disequilibrium within the society itself. And everyone is challenged in his loyalty. Are you going to be loyal to the tradition, to the form, to the morality and myth of your society? Or are you going to be loyal to truth? They are two different things. This is the problem in teaching. This is the problem in bringing up your children. This is the problem that was beside me there at the lunch counter. The parents, the teachers in those cases, were on the side of society, of the past, of what has been achieved. And I think one could say that it is the tendency of society in general to take the position of reasserting its authority even against the truth. And societies that have chosen this pattern, they are the more numerous in the world. They are distinguished by inquisitions, liquidations, annihilations of all who speak out the truth. This is a crucial problem. And one just has to know how far the truth goes. One has to realize how far it goes in shattering. It shatters the whole thing. The myths are myths from top to bottom. They are, in terms of the fact world, untrue. And there is another science that has come to play on this theme. And this is the science of psychology. There's been a wonderful, extremely interesting development in the past 40 years in the attitude of psychologists to these mythological matters. When you read the great work of Fraser, The Golden Bough, first editions of the first volumes around 1890, you find a completely negative attitude toward the myths. He describes them as mistakes that were made by people who didn't know enough. His formula is that because ideas happen to be associated in people's minds, they imagine them to be associated in fact. And they try to relate to the world in terms of their own imaging, and the imaging does not correspond to the world of fact. And he says, these old ideas are doomed to die with the new world of scientific discovery. Then we have the period of Freud, the end of the 90s and the first two or three decades of this century. And he sees the myths as manifestations of the unconscious. Myths, for Freud, are, so to say, public dreams, and dreams are private myths. And the only difference between a religion and a neurosis is that the religion is more popular, and the person with the neurosis feels isolated. But they are both manifestations of compulsive imaging out of the psyche. And the arts that depict these images are symptoms, as it were, of the psyche. And for Freud, this was all very morbid. Another point of view is that of Jung, who saw these rather as assistants to human life. Human consciousness is out of touch with the dynamics of the body, of the unconscious. And these dynamics are made manifest in the myth. They are, as Freud suggested, projections. But says Jung, through a dialogue with these, one can come to know one's own self. One can come to terms with the greater horizon of one's own self. And the society that dwells with these is feeding the deeper realms, the deeper strata of the human psyche. So that a positive attitude has been taken to the myths. They serve man They create his world for him, but they do not correspond to any facts. Now, as I've said, many societies resist the truth and insist on their mythology. What happens to such societies? What one may say is the negative aspect of the impact of science on myth. What happens to the society that refuses to accept it? There is a history of this situation. As you know, the first beginnings, really, of hard-headed looking at things is with the Greeks of the 7th and 6th centuries. And by the period of Alexander, the 4th and 3rd centuries, there was quite a scientific academy and quite a scientific tradition. And the attitude of science had already been developed. Alexandrian science was carried across Asia, across Persia, as far as to India. And the influence went actually into India and into China from those areas. But every single one of the Oriental societies, that of Persia and Iraq, that of India, that of China, had its revelation of truth. And the objective, realistic, inquisitive, experimental attitude of the Greek was rejected. One of the most interesting examples is the example of Islam, the Mohammedan world, which shared with Rome and Europe the Greek heritage. And for the first couple of centuries of Islamic history, there was a wonderful fermentation of science. The 8th and 9th and 10th centuries in Islam are wonderful. And then the authority of the Quran and the authority of the Sunnah, the group, the consensus, the people who are always right, as Muhammad said, and are consequently always wrong, they won. And the scientific spirit was extruded. It was squeezed out, and Islam went dead. It's been dead since the 12th century. But the European spirit, which received the message openly, at least in certain of its important characters, who were willing to fight their way through the resistance, Europe grew. And there is a line of wise men, of rishis, of sages, I would say from the period of Leonardo on down, which is unmatched in human history. And the magnitude of the revelation of the marvel of the universe that the West has brought into being. And the magnitude and richness of life here is something totally unknown in the realms that hung on to their old traditions. One finds that historical development in the Orient takes place as the result of invasions. Each group has its fixed tradition, and the one that wins establishes its tradition, so that the history is in crises, whereas there is a much more organic development in the Western line, and this is the result of having accepted, as it were, the problem of truth. But now when one says truth, as a scientist, one is being sentimental. Because really the wonderful thing and the great challenge of the scientific revelation is that science itself does not pretend to be true. It does not pretend to be final. It is simply an organization of working hypotheses. Hypotheses that seem to take account of the facts as we now know them. But is there any intention to stay with these facts? No. There is a continuous quest for more, as though one were eager to grow, as though the life of man and of society here were to be based on new things, on change, on transformation, rather than on petrifaction and rigidity. And so, we don't know anything. And even science itself is not the truth. It is only, so to say, an eagerness for the truth, no matter where it may lead. And so here again, we have a still greater revelation than that of anything the old texts have to say. The old texts comfort us with horizons. They tell us that a loving, a kind, a just Father is out there. According to the scientific view, nobody knows what is out there, or if there is any out there at all. There's just a display of things that our senses bring to us, and we're dealing with those. But what lies beyond is an ultimate mystery. And it's a mystery that is so great that it is going to be inexhaustible in its revelations. And man has to be great enough to receive it. There is no thou shalt anymore. There is nothing you have to believe, nothing you have to do. And if you want to play the game of the Middle Ages, go ahead. But don't tell anybody else that that's the only game there is. Or if you want to play the game of the Chinese mandate of heaven, go ahead. Those are all lovely games. And the scientific game, after all, may not be any truer, but it's vaster, and it takes in a bigger range of facts and experience. So it is this terrific moment that we face. It's a moment that has been maturing, so to say, since the days of the Greeks. And since the days of the Second World War, it has gone through all the planets.